Hi, everybody. I'm Kate.
And I'm Heather.
And we're Making Life.
Interviewee is Lynn Knoll, who's a singer, songwriter, and storyteller of heritage traditions. She's also a trailblazer in the world of digital. She brings all of those skills and her experience as a session founder to her work as a producer and host of her online folk club, the Mermaid's Tavern. Thank you for coming, Lynn.
Yay, Lynn!
Delighted to be here.
Fantastic. So you're currently known as the mastermind behind Mermaid's Tavern. And you're also a singer and storyteller doing things on your own, too. Does running an online folk club influence the way you work as a performer? And if so, how?
So that's a really good question. I have an umbrella called Digital Heritage Consulting that we'll talk more about as we go through this. And my solo work as a performer under that umbrella comes on my label, Cross Currents Music. Mm-hmm. So the question is, does running the Mermaid's Tavern, we could say, does it bring in money to Cross Currents, or has it changed how I run Cross Currents and how I think about it as a business? Mm, and the answer is maybe to the first, and you bet to the second.
So, and how has it changed?
So I wish I could tell you that 10% of my session mailing list has bought one of my albums. It's more like 2%, but it wouldn't be that much without the Mermaid's Tavern, because my mailing list is a real core of what I'm doing right now. And at present, certainly since COVID, my primary line of business is not solo performing. It's session leading and organizing. Now, I used to make my money from venues and live performance like everybody else. But since COVID, I'm most measurably successful as a session leader, which is a combination of organizing and listening. That's done a lot for me as a performer that I didn't expect. Certainly as a business person, what I've found is, as a session leader, the music that I do isn't a product for an audience. It's a service to the community. And that really changes the economics, I think, in my favor, because I brought in more in donations last year than I did in product sales. Mm-hmm. And so during lockdown, you know, you look at the kind of traditional, conventional side of performance as a business. You can look at audience draw, who comes. You can look at donations and tips. You can look at album sales. And I do consistently best on all of those metrics when I'm doing participatory special events. I did a Christmas Carol Sing. I did a Robert Burns Night. I did a Tamlin Marathon, a single ballad for 3 hours.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, it was awesome. And that kind of participatory special event is what has drawn the most to the audience. So the question of, am I changing as a performer? Yeah, absolutely. It's influencing my solo work because it's really clear now who my audience is and what they like. So next up, I'm going to do a child ballad CD, which I might not have done. Because before that, I wasn't really known as a ballad singer, but it's been a year now and I've run 104 ballad sings.
Wow. Is that, so that's like two a week for the whole pandemic
it's
or what?
It's a lot.
yeah.
I have an audience that loves ballads. They love to listen to ballads. I'm sorry, 104, that can't be right. I did that wrong. It's one a week. Mm-hmm. It was 52. Mm-hmm. And then I did another every other 2 weeks. So it's every 2 weeks.
Wow.
Through the pandemic. Wow. Yeah. They love to listen to ballads. So my performing focus is shifting from what I wanted most to say in my last CD to what my audience wants to hear for my next one. And I'll probably tack back and forth across that harbor. But for right now, I'm responding to people who want to hear me sing. And that's definitely coming from the Mermaid's Tavern.
Awesome. By the way, I had no idea that you were planning a CD of child ballads, and I personally am totally stoked about that. Yay.
Can you explain for everyone who doesn't know what that is? Like, upon first hearing child ballads, we might think they're ballads about children.
So they were ballads collected by a folklorist at Harvard named Francis James Child. And there are 325 of them. And they have all sorts of names and labels on them. And Professor Child categorized them and identified themes and really sort of put a motif on them. So you could say, oh, that's a variant of child number 36, because no matter what version of it you collected, you can recognize that, oh yeah, that's the one about where the two sisters go walking by the riverside and one of them pushes the other one in. And that happens to be child number 10, the two sisters. So no matter where you hear that, you can hear, oh yeah, that's child ballad number 10.
He was, in fact, the first person to do that organizing as well, which is why he is such a big deal in ballad world.
That's right.
What year was that happening? When was he collecting them?
1890s.
Okay. I think it's really great that you're able to connect with your audience in such a way that you really know what they're listening for and that you are able to provide that to them. Have you picked out which ballads you will sing yet?
I'm down to about 25.
That's pretty good.
I need to pick half of that. I have been working on a ballad album for the better part of 20 years. My albums have a tendency to, like, my mother was a knitter, and she used to describe something called second sleeve syndrome, which is that you've knit the front, you've knit the back, that's different. You've knit one sleeve, that's different. The second sleeve is the same as the first, so it's boring. And I have a lot of projects that suffer from second sleeve syndrome. I like to start things a lot more than I like to finish them. So making myself actually finish a CD is really different than starting one.
Totally. We've talked with a lot of other guests who also wear multiple creative hats about the pull to monetize hobbies. Do you struggle with that impulse too? And how do you decide whether to indulge, ignore, or table it? This is going off of the it's easy to start something and not so easy to finish it.
Yes. Well, you and I, Kate, have talked about this before. I want you to close your eyes and imagine a clock with four labels at noon, 3, 6, and 9. And the first three are conform, go crazy, or become an artist. And the fourth one that nobody ever talks about is go broke. I've been through that spin cycle enough times that I can tell when I'm out of balance. Sometimes I want to monetize my hobbies, but I'm really clear. Right now, I don't monetize my music as my primary source of income. I do monetize it, but it's not how I pay the rent because I simply don't want to be that poor again. I've been that poor and I'm proud of having created choices for myself so I can choose to monetize some of my time in ways that I don't mind in order to buy time for stuff that I genuinely enjoy. Like, for example, I serve on two nonprofit boards, which is a totally non-monetizable hobby. It's important to find some hobbies that you do just because you love them and not necessarily monetize everything because you can start to hate it.
Yeah. Which things that you have monetized would you say are the most successful? Like, which things are helping you make your living? You do your art and also have your business. To what degree do they overlap or not overlap?
Okay. So now we're going to get to what digital heritage consulting is. Mm-hmm. And you actually asked me a question earlier about whether sometimes this is about business and music and sometimes at the same time, but not always. So let me unpack that a little. Mm-hmm. Digital heritage consulting has two sides, the digital side and the heritage side. They complement each other. But DHC is about digital and data management and about heritage interpretation and education. I do both of those things for a living, and one of them pays way more than the other one. Mm. I made as much from heritage work all last year as I make in a month working corporate tech.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you're going to monetize something, pick something that monetizes well. That's just basically a wise call. There was a time when I was building databases for fun and doing music as a living. And somebody said, this is backwards. do you know you can get paid for this? And I went, really, what? So I don't always love every aspect of either career. But especially in today's economy, if you have a dual career, it gives me a range of choices. I can sort of twiddle the knobs when my life isn't going in the right direction. And it's really important. As an artist, there is real confidence in knowing you can pay the rent. Virginia Woolf said a woman must have money and a room of her own. So if I can reflect for a moment, music can be a business and it can be an avocation. It can be something for fun. Business can be a vocation, something you're called to do, or it can be a day job to bring home the bacon. And you can do either one of those things at either time. But what I care the most about is from a Robert Frost poem. Will you indulge me if I give you a Robert Frost poem?
Yes.
That I set the tune to. But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one and the work is play for mortal stakes is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sake. Where work is play for mortal stakes. There's a wonderful time to get to do that. I can also tell you there's times when you just want to show up and work and get paid. Both of those things are really true.
That is great. Yeah. That was beautiful also. Thank you. Thank you. It kind of brought me back to, you know, all the times that I've gotten to hear you sing. And one of the first ones of them, actually, it just made me, listening to your voice is beautiful. And one of the first times I ever got to hear it was at the USS Constitution Chanty Sing.
Yeah.
And you were so welcoming and kind there and just made me as a newcomer feel extremely okay and comfortable in that space. And I was wondering if that's something you do intentionally and is it important to you? How do you do that?
Oh, yeah. That is a great topic, and I have a lot to say.
Good.
Yeah. It is really intentional, and it has to not look intentional. Mm-hmm. Greeting every individual newcomer is really important to me, just like I'm welcoming people into my home. I want everybody to have this really comfortable, easy sense that you've come inside and you can relax and enjoy yourself. And that's even more important in a virtual space. And what's been fascinating to me as the virtual space that is the Mermaid's Tavern has evolved, that it has come to feel like a local pub. And I'm really happy just behind the bar there. You know, I'm in my own tavern with my people and I'm the barmaid. I'm running the place. It's great. So that said, I think there's a real sweet spot between setting the bar too low musically so that listeners get critical and bored. And setting it too high so that the singers feel intimidated. At a session, if you have 20 people, the same person is a listener 19 times out of 20. So everybody's a listener 10 to 20 times more than they're a singer. Mm-hmm. So how do you make sure that they have a good listening experience as well as a good singing experience? It's really important to me that somebody singing in public for the first time feels successful and welcomed, especially if they're struggling a little bit. I don't want anybody to feel embarrassed. I will give the side eye to anybody who's fidgeting in their seat while somebody is singing and really having a hard time with it. Like, no, we are all supposed to make this an easy room. That said, I'm working myself on not singing to the lowest common denominator. I want to praise excellence. I want to release myself and everybody in the room from the guilt that comes when somebody says, oh, I could never follow that. I could never sing like that. If you apologize for your talent and you hide your light under a bushel, it sets a really bad example.
Yeah. It's a weird balance to strike. I hear people, whenever I go to a gig or even when I'm at a pub sing here in Rhode Island, I haven't been there for a long time, but every time I hear somebody say, oh, I can't sing.
Yeah.
Because I also try partially inspired by you and partially inspired by other mentors of mine in the community, I try really hard to greet everybody in the room, especially if they're new, and say, hey, I'm really glad you're here, because I am. Not because I feel like I have to say it, but because when I got here, everybody said that to me and it felt like home real yep. fast. And so I try really hard to do that. But then sometimes what happens is I will start getting to know somebody and then I'll sing something and then they'll go, oh, I don't sound like that. I can't sing. Cause I'll say, give us a song, give us a song. We're glad you're here. And they'll be like, but I can't sing. I don't know how to. And my reaction to that is always, well, but this is trad music. This is folk music. And in Rhode Island, we say it doesn't even have to be trad. As long as it's got what we call joiny inny bits, you should sing yep. it. Because as long as you can sing it with other people, that's the point. And that's, I don't know, I struggle with helping people to understand that we are specifically singing this stuff partially because its function was to bring people together after a long day of work or to get them through a task or to help them pass time in a pleasant way. And it's not about performing. It's not a performance.
It is absolutely not. And I debated whether I was going to tell this story, but I will tell it. At a session last weekend, we had a new singer who had never, ever, ever sung in public before. Fella from Newfoundland, delightful Newfoundland accent. I was just thrilled to hear him be there at all. And just really wonderful to see him arrive. And he chose a really challenging song. And one of the things I do is during each and every song, I have a little mindfulness exercise as a session leader. I focus on what I'm going to say to praise the singer when they finish. I'm going to find something uniquely good about the performance and say it with genuine conviction. And I worked. And I thought really hard. And I thought, how am I going to really make this legit and not sound like I'm struggling? I said, the tempo on that was really listenable. It was really good that you chose the tempo so that people could understand all the words. And he lit right up. Now, I'll tell you, and of course he knew as well, that as we politely say about the tune, well, you had it surrounded by.
What does that mean?
You had it surrounded. Or, sometimes you're above it, sometimes you're below it, but you got it surrounded now.
I like that.
You're closing in on it. And that's okay, because here was somebody who had picked a song that he loved to listen to, and he actually got through all the words. You know, the tone will come. I'm fine with that. This is the first time he ever sang anything in public, and he wrote me a note afterwards that said, can I come back? Do you have any constructive criticism for me? And I'm saying right now, out loud in this podcast, yes, come back. We want you. And the best thing that you can do is to come and listen to all of these really fine singers and some not so fine singers that we've got here so that you too can become a part of this and you can sing the songs that you love to listen to. And that's okay. And that's part of the welcoming space creed.
That's totally. It reminds me also of the thing that I've heard about shanties from a couple people in the community, which is there are two ways to sing shanties. You can sing them pretty or you can sing them authentically.
Okay.
Your feelings about that?
I have feelings about that. I have complicated, but that's okay.
I have complicated feelings yes. about that also.
So that's it clear. It is true that while I have complicated feelings about that, I totally understand where it's coming from. And I was never prouder than for the 20 years that I still have had on my website, Mystic Seaport, saying, real head back and let fly sea shanties about the work that I do. Yeah, trying to get that authenticity in there is a really important thing. And that's why my friend with the rocky road to Dublin is always going to be welcome at my sessions.
Yeah, there's kind of a parallel that happens in the henna artist world at conferences, which I guess are the closest thing we have to pub sings, like where everyone just comes together and we take classes, we learn things, but we also just trade henna and hang out. I guess online, in online forums, there's a similar thing too. But the newer henna artists often have this like, oh, I'm not as good as you guys. I couldn't possibly do henna for you and stuff like that. And it's so important to just be like, no, it's good. We're all here to do henna. So please do henna on me, because that is the whole point. And when people hear that, they're like surprised and so happy, and they come back the next year to the henna conference. And it's just really nice to be welcoming to those newcomers. And I appreciate when other people do that. And I try to also do it.
Yeah, that comes back to the idea that doing henna for another person is a service to the community. It's not a product that you're putting on somebody's hand for them as a performance, as to an audience. You are serving the community in exchanging this gift to each other.
It very much is. It's like, I guess the singing and henna are again similar. Yeah, because it's an exchange of energy in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, very much so.
Let's see. Before we get too far away from Mermaid's Tavern things, we wanted to ask you a little bit about, how did you get the tavern off the ground? How did you decide to call it that? And what have you learned through the process of running a digital, like, online tavern, which is kind of a new concept this year, I would say.
Logistically, how did you get it together? And also, was there something in the process of getting it together and getting it off the ground that you learned that you didn't expect to?
So let me see if I can unpack that one, because getting it off the ground, there was the run up, and then there was the actual flapping. There was a lot of flapping. Ready? There was a long runway before the flapping started. So I guess I have to tell you the beginning story. The Mermaid's Tavern has an origin story, which is that it was the 11th of March a year ago, and I was in the car. I just left my last physical therapy appointment for my bum shoulder, and I was on my way to a gig where my physical therapist had told me, this is not a non sequitur, that I should not be lifting heavy equipment. So I picked up the phone and I called the venue and I said, can somebody meet me at the door and help me unload the gear? Because I'm going to be the first one of the band there. And they said, the Board of Health is on the phone. Just hang on a minute. Now, I'm 45 minutes away from the gig and an hour and a half away from the performance. And that's how I found out that the governors issued an emergency order and shut us all down.
Mm.
So there I sat in the parking lot of the physical therapy office with a car full of sound gear. And I said, right, guess I'm going home now. I was actually supposed to be getting on a plane the next day to go to my father's memorial service. And I was supposed to fly through Seattle to go to LA. Mm. So, I don't know what you remember from last year about Seattle and LA and the coronavirus, but my brother called me that afternoon and said, we're canceling the funeral. You should not come. The airline will refund your tickets on 12 hours notice. Now, at that time, I had said to Lynn Feingold, who's the president of the Folk Song Society of Greater Boston, she was having trouble finding someone, anyone to host Matthew Byrne from Newfoundland. Wonderful artist, always has a big draw. We had two big homes that said they didn't want to have anybody in their homes. That, again, the governor's order, we shouldn't gather more than 25 people. Should we have this at all? Mm-hmm. And I had said, well, you can use my house. I won't be here. And then I am going to be here. We talked about four times that afternoon. And Lynn Feingold said, can you live stream Matthew Byrne? And I said, well, I got a couple of old Macintoshes in the basement, and I think I can go live on Facebook. All you need to know about that is that 24 hours later at 7:15 p.m., I did not have sound, and we went live at 7:30 to an audience of 300.
Wow. So you got nerves of
steel. Nerves of steel. I have nerves of steel. you just don't think about it. It's either going to work or not work, because these are extraordinary times. So I live streamed my first concert because I had to. My claim to fame is that I was the first person to live stream Matthew Byrne, who has gone on to have an incredibly successful online career in the last year. Matthew sat in my laundry room I mean, it sounds a lot classier to say that I have a digital studio in the basement than to say, tell I have a couple of computers in my laundry room, but that's really what I have.
They can both be true at the same time.
And it's called the Mermaid's Tavern because that's what the space has been called for a long time, because I'm a shanty singer. My husband's a marine biologist, and we divide the downstairs of our house in half. And half of it is Drudge and Phil's dive bar, and the other half is the Mermaid's Tavern, and it depends on whose books are where.
I love that so much.
So the dive bar and the Mermaid's Tavern were where we were all going to get together and, you know, drink beer and sing in the basement. The Mermaid's Tavern was supposed to be a home digital studio back in the before times when people went to each other's houses. The idea was that you were all supposed to be able to come to my house and do your own music. And, you know, we were going to have a salon, right, where Heather was going to be doing henna on me while Kate was recording her new album. And then we were all going to sit down and listen to what Kate had done and admire Heather's henna. So I did a session the next week because the shanty sing was canceled. So I said, let's have it on Zoom.
Context, can you tell people who don't know what a session is?
A session is a gathering where people, let's call it a sing-around, where you're going to arrive and each person is going to sing around in a circle. And when we're not on Zoom and we can sing together, my favorite kinds of sessions, although they're not the only kind, are harmony sessions where everybody else gets to join in. We encourage chorus songs that have Joni Innie bits. So songs with Joni Innie bits are always welcome. But one of the things I discovered here again, getting the Mermaid's Tavern off the ground, was that suddenly there was an opportunity for solo songs because you couldn't sing together. So the third week of lockdown, I said, let's have a ballad sing. Ballads are story songs, not necessarily ones collected by Francis James Child or other ballad collectors, but some people think of them as long, boring songs where way too much happens with a very small amount of tune. There's more to ballads than that, but it's true that there is a large body of 5 to 10 minute songs, which is long by today's standards. And so an opportunity for longer songs and an opportunity for listening was something that Zoom gave us, which I think was pretty cool.
Yeah. Besides the opportunity for ballads, was there something in the logistics of getting the tavern off the ground that surprised you? It's okay.
Certainly the success of it, how popular it was. Like I said, there was a lot of flapping there. Things really took off in May and June because I invested a lot in my web presence in March and April. I have a lot of websites. I refurbished them all. I put up a business Facebook page. I built landing pages for MailChimp. I did a tip jar. I did a Bandcamp page. I did a Patreon. And then I worked through the whole user experience flow. How is somebody going to find me on Facebook, get invited to an event, sign up for the mailing list, get a Zoom link, push that Zoom link live stream back to Facebook? How is that all going to work? And how do I get that as frictionless as I possibly can? And I worked on that really hard in April, especially with the mailing list, because I wanted people to be able to just grab the mailing list. And I wanted the mailing list to be the only place people got Zoom links. That process served me really well now that people can find my mailing list, join it really without any engagement from me. It's mailinglist.linol.com for those who want to know. Important to have a really speakable URL. And then I was able to get to the point where I was focusing primarily on the audience as fast as I could and not letting logistics get me. You can learn logistics, and the best way to learn them is by doing them. I made every mistake in the book. That's how we learn. Good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment.
That's a cycle and a half. Can you tell us about a tool or system that you have or that you found or that you put together that makes doing all of this easier or that makes your work life
balance?
Well,
I could blather on about tools and systems all you want, as you know. Shameless plug here. In fact, part of what I do under Digital Heritage Consulting is what I call DIY digital, do-it-yourself digital, and you can hire me as a solution architect to help you figure out what free and low-cost tools you guys need to use and how you can use them together as integrated systems. That said, I'll tell you about two, one for graphics for Heather and one for music for Kate. Super. Heather, do you know about Adobe Spark?
Thank you.
No, not really. Ah,
okay. I am a huge fan of Adobe Spark. It lets you make really quick graphics for my newsletter, for Facebook events. Right now, I can copy one of my existing events, drop in a new photo. It's got all the branding on it. I can build a Facebook event in 5 minutes. I can build a month's worth of newsletter content in an hour. I keep all of my graphics templated in Spark, and Adobe Spark lets me set up a standard template for Facebook and for my newsletter. And then I just swap out the pictures and I've got all my branding all done up front. So that one's pretty great in terms of just being able to do my social media work really fast.
Is that something you do on a desktop or a laptop or on your phone?
It's in the cloud. It's in the cloud. You can do it on your phone. You can do it on the laptop, either one.
Mm-hmm.
I find it easier to do on the desktop because I'm always juggling. I'm grabbing this photo from here and that photo from somebody else's website and, you know, compositing them together really quick. I've got a gig coming up on Saturday with Janie Manili, doing Strong Songs, Strong Women for Women's History Month. Janie pitched this to me Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, and I had the newsletter out by noon.
Awesome.
Sweet.
Is there a reason to use Adobe Spark over, say, InDesign or Photoshop?
Spark is simpler
for
me. Photoshop is a Swiss Army knife. It's got lots and lots and lots of cool tools. If I were going to be actually doing design and graphics myself, I can't draw. Okay. I don't draw. Spark lets me play collage. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's all it is it's a paste up place where you can do type and graphics and images and drop them in together. It's not a drawing tool.
Yeah. Gotcha. So it's straightforward.
Yeah. It's really simple. And for Kate, I have to mention something really amazing about mastering. Now, I have bought myself a subscription to a cloud app called CloudBounce that uses artificial intelligence to do a gazillion of the little tweaks that a mastering engineer would do to master a whole album. Mastering engineers charge on CD Baby, it's $49 a track. If you're lucky to find an engineer for $75 an hour, that's amazing. That would have been $850 to $1,275 for one pass at mastering. And for $200, I could get CloudBounce and I could master each track myself and then the whole album as many times as I wanted and listen to it, play with it, do it again. And I was really impressed with the value and the quality, especially because I'm going to do another album this year. I was really fascinated with how they've put artificial intelligence into the mastering process. We can talk more about my adventures into self-production. But if you ask me about cool tools, Spark and CloudBounce are two of my favorites.
Awesome. Thanks for those. I'm definitely looking into CloudBounce now. Yes, we were going to ask you about self-production because you did your whole most recent album, Gold St. Lawrence,
I did.
That way, didn't you?
And I would say that I'm a dabbler at this point, but I have done it on principle for a long time. I started with self-production originally because I got burned by a couple of shadow artist boyfriends who wanted to control me through my work.
Mm.
And that wasn't okay. And I was really not interested in having a Svengali who wanted to produce me. And so I felt really strongly about controlling the means of production. And then everybody I talked to said, mixing and mastering are distinct skill sets. You should never try to mix or master your own stuff. You need another ear. You know, you're not objective enough. Well, then I got really curious because I was looking around and going, I see all of these guys with basements full of gear that spend oodles of time and money building home studios and doing their own recordings. And who's telling them not to mix their own stuff? I'm
right.
Just curious. I'm just asking.
No one.
Yeah. So why are people telling me this? So I hired a young woman from Berkeley to teach me to mix. And then I took about 150 hours of classes in Logic Pro, which is way more than I needed, but it was good to know that. And then I built the couple of workstations from old Macs in the basement. Hot tip, I have since upgraded that to a new Mac because I needed to do some heavy lifting and some of my Macs were just not up to editing video. You require a fair amount of muscle to do that, and an older machine wasn't doing it for me. But like I said, that was back when the Mermaid's Tavern was supposed to be this, you know, digital studio and salon. I would love to work in a studio, but it's not cost effective for me. It would be self-indulgent. I just don't make enough in album sales to cover the costs of a studio recording. If you look at each of my albums and look at the finances, it's a hobby. I record to get my music out there. I record to leave a legacy, to make art. That's what I do. But going back into a studio for a full-blown album, right now it wouldn't be a sound business decision. I would get much better return on investment doing this the lightweight way, even if it means I'm only using one or two mics and trying to get multiple people. The layering of tracks and all that kind of stuff, if I had it to do over again, I would do it live and record it in my living room.
I think that by putting in the investment you said of like 150 hours into learning Logic Pro, which is that your mixing software? Am I correct?
Yeah.
You have already gained so many skills by doing that. My husband actually is one of those guys who has a room full of music equipment, and he's been learning over the past, decade, I would say, to mix and master and all of that, and all the bands he's in. He produces the albums and does all the recording, mixing, mastering, with, of course, other ears to kind of give a second listen and give some feedback. But it is the most economically sensible choice. There is no way that all the albums that have come out of this studio that is called Triforium Records would ever have happened if they weren't recorded, mixed, and mastered all in that studio. So it's so empowering to do it yourself.
Yeah.
And it's great
it really is.
That you learn the tools. That's really what it takes. Learn the tools, get a powerful enough computer, good enough mic, and you're good to go.
Well, I just had to say to myself, well, wait a minute. I've been in tech for 20 years. Why am I not doing this?
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
it's really frustrating that
it's just computers.
Right? And it's frustrating to me that people were discouraging to you and telling you that that was not a good idea. That kind of makes me mad for you. And I wonder who was saying that.
They were not just sexist swine, I can tell you that. Some of them absolutely had a point. Okay. And I had an epiphany about all of this. After releasing Gulf of St. Lawrence, which was not so much released, but finally booted out of the cage where it spent 5 years cowering in the closet and said, right, you need to go out and be in the world. Out you go. Go on.
It needed a second sleeve.
Yeah, I finished the second sleeve. I got it done. And then I listened to it after it was launched and thought, oh no, you idiot. This is terrible. Oh.
No. Not, it's stellar. And I'm not saying that because this is our podcast. I'm saying that because of all the things I've heard you make so far. This is absolutely my favorite. I will not get on a soapbox about it.
Thank you.
I have feelings
so
about this album.
One of the things I have learned.
You're welcome.
Is that training is no substitute for experience. Mm-hmm. My ear is not yet, and I say yet, trained to the point of patience with listening to the same thing over and over and over, whether it's my own work or something else. And so the thing that I value the most now is when somebody takes that critical ear and listens and says, and I had people do this with me, some of them, you, Kate, really say, you know, the balance is off here, or these two songs, one of them has too much space before it, or this one sounds muddy next to the other one. When you've listened to it 67 million times, you don't always hear that.
It reminds me of why they say that if you are going to direct a show, you should not also act in the thing. There are specific situations where, and I've been in a couple of them, where you can have a collaborative theatrical experience where there isn't so much a director as there is a group of people who are going to put a thing together. And there's one person who has to be the one who says, okay, this is the final decision. Now we can move on to the next step. Because if you don't have that, you're just going to get stuck in rehearsal forever and ever and ever. And it'll be, you know, the nicest purgatory I've ever heard of, but it's still purgatory. So, you know, you can make that choice to have one person make the final choices, but everybody is working on the thing together. But that being said, I have also been in a lot of projects where there is a definitive director and that person is not touching the acting side. It's for the same reasons. You can't be objective about what's happening on stage if you're so busy emotionally connecting to the words and allowing your personal experience to inform a character.
That's right.
You can't look at everybody
else.
And
one of the things that I needed to learn to do, and I'm really glad that I had my own studio to do it in and I wasn't paying somebody $75 an hour, is that I needed to learn how to record. I've done 5 albums now and parts of others. Probably more than that if I count up all the times that I have sat in front of a microphone and had somebody hit play. But to get what's coming out of me onto some kind of medium where it can be reproduced, giving a good performance is all-encompassing. And I totally understand why you would not want someone to be having to be their own recording engineer. Now, let's be fair. Would I choose not to be my own recording engineer if I had a choice right now? Maybe so, maybe not. But I certainly want to be able to know how to do it. Because again, I believe, like I said, I believe in controlling the means of production. And I love to be able to just, you know, run downstairs in the basement. And if I'm in the mood, to lay down a track. That's really cool. At the same time, it would be really nice if somebody else were running the knobs so that I could focus on emoting.
Yeah, so that kind of takes you back to what the Mermaid's Tavern was going to be, right? You could have a few friends over, someone That's can right. hit record, and then you can give your good performance, and it's just kind of friends hanging out and helping each other in that way.
The idea was, and maybe someday will still be, that anybody knows how to do any of the roles. It's a collaborative acting and directing exercise. I'm That's such cool. an idealist.
It's great. I love it.
Love it. I have a shirt that says shameless idealist. I can get you one if you want.
I believe I don't need a shirt. I think it's fairly clear.
Oh, by the way, I should point out also that I am currently wearing the Though She Be But Little, She Is Fierce t-shirt that you gave me to point out to me that I am a freelancer and no longer
That's
have
right.
a boss.
Absolutely.
Dobby is a free elf.
Heather, do you know that story?
I kind of know it. I forget things. Kate definitely told it to me. Do you want to tell us again, though? Because our podcast listeners have definitely not.
I think it's important to know because Kate, like many folks who are experienced at only working for somebody else, kept asking me for direction and kept asking me for her next assignment and generally engaging with me like a boss instead of as a client.
Lynn was, by yes. the way, my first freelance client.
And
for
so
full context.
We were doing really well with this. And I couldn't somehow convey this. So I had the great privilege of being at Kate's house. So I bent over and I took off my boot and I took off my sock and I handed it to Kate. And I said, Master has given Dobby a sock. Dobby is a free elf.
I didn't know there was physical sock taking off.
There was an actual physical sock involved.
After I had stopped crying with laughter, a couple of days later, I got a package in the mail. And when I opened it, I discovered a t-shirt that says, Though she be but little, she is fierce. Midsummer Night's Dream. And the note just said, Dobby is a free elf with no signature or name
exactly
or anything.
That's fantastic. Also, I know that obviously we all like Harry Potter a lot and totally get that reference. But in case anyone is not as big of a Harry Potter nerd, it's a Harry Potter thing. The house elf who has always taken direction and been someone's house elf finally gets to go off and be free. live his life. So Kate's off living her life, yes, being free, yes, and freelancing.
Unfortunate that the maker of Harry Potter has revealed herself to be bigoted in some way. But I am grateful that her stories are out in the world and that we can still reclaim them. Have things like Dobby is a free elf to teach us that we are freelancers and can captain our own professional.
It's important to know these things.
Yeah. So when one is one's definitely own boss, there's all these things that come along with that. There's all these responsibilities and things you have to do, hats you have to wear, and liabilities that perhaps you have. Since Digital Heritage Consulting is a limited liability company, could you tell us the story of why you decided to make it one? And do you have any words of wisdom for other people who might want to do the same?
Straight up business decision had absolutely nothing to do with music on the surface. Mm-hmm. In 2018, I got hired as a data management consultant by a little firm. We call them boutique firms that only worked business to business. They would only hire other businesses. So I had to become a business in order to get paid. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't have made sense if I hadn't had a corporate client. And it's not necessarily a good choice just for a side hustle. For me, it took me a while to get all of the ducks in the row, but actually I believe I have managed to convince my tax preparer that this is all legitimately one business and not two. I call this my Robin Hood business model. My corporate contract income goes into the business bucket. And just for folks that don't know what a limited liability company is, it's a separate financial bucket from your household money. Easiest way to think of it, it's the business is another thing. That means, for example, if somebody sues me, they can sue Digital Heritage Consulting. They can't sue me personally if they're suing DHC. That means there is a limit to liability. They can't take my house if I do something so dreadful through my business. Mm-hmm. The important thing for me was that I wanted one bucket of money for all of my income and all of my expenses. And that came when I had decided I was going to be a free elf and I was not again going to be an employee. And that meant that all of the stuff I do, none of it was going to be side hustle. It was all hustle. All the time. So my corporate contract income mm-hmm. goes into the bucket. All my gig money goes into the bucket, my tips, donations, hourly coaching work, album sales, everything goes in there. And out of that comes my legitimate business expenses, including first up my self-employment tax, all of my startup costs, my buying a new computer, mm-hmm. all of my almost certainly too much studio gear. LLC keeps all those expenses out of the household account and keeps me honest that I am not just pouring money into a hobby. And at the end of the year, my personal business goal is to have taken enough in owner's draw to support our household and then to have something left to make a contribution to my retirement fund. I'm not trying to grow my business or sell it or do anything like that. If you are interested in running a business that is going to become larger than you yourself, that's another story. I probably, now that I am not working for that single corporate client, I don't have to do this because I'm a contractor, but I like having an LLC.
Yeah, I personally just have a sole proprietorship and have yep. not jumped into having the LLC, mostly because I feel pretty confident I will never do anything bad enough that someone will need to take yep. my house. But it really would be more comfortable to have that layer in between yeah. me and the ability to sue me, for sure.
I didn't do it for liability reasons. I did it because I had to in order to do business.
Yeah. Right? I got insurance for that reason, business insurance specifically.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this was in the not art side of my life when I'm working corporate. There are two ways to work as a corporate consultant. You can work contract, which means you're subcontracting, you're subbing to like a staffing firm that has agreed to provide resources, headcount mm-hmm. to a client company. And then you can be your own staffing firm and provide yourself directly. Now, as it happens right now, I'm subbing, so I don't need to have an LLC. But should I want to work for somebody directly, they can hire me without going through a staffing firm, which means they don't have to pay markup on me, which means I get more of the money.
Right. That's always nice. Cutting out the middleman. Actually, is your story, I feel like maybe a lot of your story is a story of cutting out the middleman and owning those means of production. And that's fantastic.
That's my intent.
Yeah. Cool.
Lynn does not mess around.
I don't intend to be ferocious about it. I like this captaining my own ship is all.
Yeah.
You don't need to be ferocious about it. You just are a ferocious person in the best possible ways. This is such a masterclass for me to hear about LLCs and to hear about business insurance and stuff, because I am in my, fourth year of working for myself and am nowhere near either of those choices. But I hadn't even considered
you don't need it until someone demands right that now. You have it, so, unless you really do think that someone might sue you.
Right.
And then sure. It comes up mostly for giant corporations that are trying to cover their own butts. So yeah, they're the ones who request the insurance and also any kind of like certification. Corporate clients are the only ones that ever want any kind of super official paperwork like that.
Yeah. There is a great deal that you can do as a small business that doesn't involve being an LLC. I ran Cross Currents as a Schedule C on my income taxes for 35 years.
I think that's a really important lesson for people to know and to hear from somebody who has experience in both fields, because we're back to legitimacy now. Heather and I end up talking about legitimacy in every episode, and we don't mean to, but there's a strong belief held, I think, especially in people who are new to self-employment and new to freelancing, that in order to be legit, in order to be real, you have to be an LLC.
No, and absolutely
not. I don't think that's actually true. And it's deeply, deeply validating to hear that from you, especially because you've been on both sides.
The existential question about being real is a Velveteen Rabbit question that does not have anything to do with your taxes.
Right.
Correct.
So it's really important to separate your existential angst about being real from the basic realities of your taxes. Go to H&R Block and pay the nice people to help you with your taxes. It's easy.
That's what I do. That's what I do, because the first year I spent 3 days crying over them and I'm never doing that again. So now I go to H&R Block and
pay the
nice people.
There are reasons why that bless the people who love to do other people's taxes, for they keep us all kind and sane.
Also, there's nothing wrong with doing your own taxes and like knowing all the ins and outs of what you can and can't write off on your Schedule C. Mm-hmm. And I still think it's kind of fun and satisfying.
So. And see, you're one of those people. Keep us all kind and sane.
That's totally true.
So I feel like we're kind of getting to wrapping up time. And there's a question that we really love and that we want to make sure we ask everyone. So can you tell us one of your favorite things about getting to be a professional creative for a living?
Working from home and not wearing shoes.
Awesome. That also has come up before. That's great. It's a very good thing. What about when you have gigs?
Well, actually, there were many years when, as a professional voyageur, I did not, in fact, have to wear shoes, although moccasins were de rigueur.
Awesome.
But really depends on how you're doing this. But I spent a lot of time barefoot in the summer in a canoe back in the day.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you about touring. We wanted to ask you about touring. So here's a question. What was different about touring life than what you had originally envisioned?
Oh, and just tell us about how touring went, because some of us don't know yet.
I have always prioritized travel. I did my master's thesis in Newfoundland. I worked on the west coast of Newfoundland for the summer of 1985, the summer of 1986. I was a volunteer at Grossmoor National Park, and the summer of 1987, I actually did my first tour of three national parks in Canada as a heritage educator and interpreter. And that was a bilingual tour called Cross Currents about integrating natural and cultural heritage. That tour won the Tree of Learning Award from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And I got a grant the next year to travel up the St. Lawrence doing a tour called Going Up River with the U.S. Wild and Scenic Rivers Program and the new, at the time, Canadian Heritage River System. I wound up getting involved with the Heritage River System to the point of working with them as an outreach educator and cultural heritage interpreter for the better part of 12 years. I wrote a book called Voyages, Canada's Heritage Rivers. And through that process, went to every province and territory in Canada and to about 40 states. And this is all before the cell phone. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's how old I am. I asked for an answering machine for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And my mother said, "You don't have a phone. You don't even have an address. What do you want an answering machine for?" I said, so I could find out. That's because I don't have any of those things. Mm-hmm. So I think the important thing about what's different is that I didn't have a vision of it. I wanted to travel. I was young and hungry. I love to travel. Mm-hmm. I think my vision of life on the road was all the traveling songs. I named my little red VW Rabbit. It was my little car. And I named it Wild Wild Heart after the Bill Stein song. And I still sing that every time I hit highway speed. I got no steady address. They call me Pony Express. And my rig is the Wild Wild Heart. And that was me for a long time.
Very cool. Just to be clear, were you singing on that tour?
Yes.
Okay. It seems like you would be, but somehow I wasn't sure from listening to the story. Cool.
I was singing and writing. I visited parks, museums, nature centers, senior centers. I was doing public education and outreach about multiple, but mostly Canadian heritage rivers. It was a provincial and federal cooperative program for heritage stewardship. I was doing public awareness and outreach for what the program was and why it was important, and getting people to understand why rivers were important and why we should preserve and protect them. So that's what I was doing. And a lot of what I was doing was singing songs about rivers. So that's how.
Cool.
Awesome. Tell us about a myth about your field or about your work that you would like to debunk.
I have to pick two myths because I have two fields. One myth is that tech is hard and complicated and confusing. And the second myth is that being a creative is not. Mm-hmm. I am appalled by the number of women that I meet that when it comes to technology, they just give up on their own analytical and problem-solving skills. It's a practice. It's a craft, just like learning an instrument or learning to write. And I think one of the things we haven't talked about much yet is that we haven't talked about the craft of any creative endeavor, just the rigor and the discipline that it takes to show up at the page, wherever the page is, and do it again and again and again and again and solve problems and break roadblocks until your human body learns to make something in a new way. That part of being a creative is hard and complicated and confusing. And just to bring it full circle, coders are some of the most creative people I know. So I think the myth I want to bust is the binary between tech and art.
I think your whole life busts that myth.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you specify women too. It's interesting to me that you're specifying that that's your experience of women
and now,
who are involved with.
Remember that I've been a woman in corporate tech for 25 years. So a lot of my experience is informed by that. Mm-hmm. And I have seen a lot more women in business operations and been in very, very male dominated tech environments. By the time I reached the end of my corporate IT career, I was the most senior woman in the sixth largest IT company in the world. And I hadn't even made director. Yeah. And so I was done with pounding on that particular glass ceiling. And I made it to vice president of a little firm for about 6 months until they went under because of COVID, which was sad. And I will be sad for a while that didn't happen because that was a job I loved with people that I was very fond of. But these things happen. So yeah, I think there probably are people of all genders who choose not to invest in their analytical and problem-solving skills about technology. But every time I turn around and I meet another woman who says, oh, my husband does all that. It's like, why is it that it's always the guys who are running the studio?
That's where all the power is, man.
I have been trying to recruit other women into tech. It's actually, there's a couple of women on the tech crew at NEFA that I'm really thrilled about. And so I don't have that vibe at all about this year's NEFA's tech crew. The whole gender binary is just non-existent right now, which is a really great way to be. I'm always happy when that happens.
NEFA, for
yes,
full context for people who don't know,
the
New England
Tech Festival. Committee. I'm on the online program committee, and I'm the newest member of the NEFA board. So I'm excited about that and looking forward to being able to help bring an 80-year-old organization that is really an institution for folk life here in New England and beyond into the 21st century with our first online festival, so that you get to come to a full live online festival with over 120 performers, 3 days, 5 tracks, 3 dance halls. It's a big do.
When is that actually happening?
This is happening on April 23rd to 25th. And you can reach the registration at neffa.org, N-E-F-F-A.org.
We will do our best to make sure this interview comes out.
That's great. The people at NEFA are really wonderful. I have been involved with NEFA since I was in high school. And being able to bring the digital heritage consulting material to that table and to be so welcomed by that group has been a real marriage of true minds, as they say, in recent weeks.
Nicely done.
Well, hey, barding is one of my favorite things to do with you.
There.
What is something you spend your time doing that people wouldn't expect to be connected to your creative work?
Taxes. No, that's a joke. I am spoiled rotten because I'm married to a retired federal bureaucrat who's really good at paperwork. And that is something that is deeply connected to my creative work that you wouldn't imagine and that I hadn't thought about. But we've talked about me as a single being. But there is something more to know about me. And that something that is deeply connected to my creative work is my marriage and my relationship with my husband. It's not because we are co-collaborators. Philip is a scientist. He's not a self-identified creative, but he loves the Mermaid's Tavern. He loves Cross Currents music, and he loves the work I do. And I spend hours at a stretch at my computer writing or organizing or planning, and Philip brings me a cup of tea with a smile, and he says, I love to support the arts. And I have never been happier or more at liberty to be a creative since we married. And I think it's really important that people see Philip and all the support work he does to make my work possible. I am the last person to expect it, but being a wife is really connected to my work.
Yeah, that's it is gorgeous. Beautiful. And it's really important that people just appreciate that kind of support that they also get from their family, their friends, their spouses. And
appreciate,
I'm really glad that he's there for you.
If you are one of the people that does that support, and if you are not the self-identified creative in the round, I got to tell you, if we didn't have audiences, none of us would be doing what we're doing.
True that, man. Absolutely. I'm also interested in the spectrum that the three of us have on this issue, because there's Lynn and Phil, who are not collaborators, but who, you know, Philip is supportive and vital in different ways. And then Heather,
all
you
the
and
time
Peter
on bands,
collaborate
yes.
sometimes.
And then on and, Henna, you know, he is more of a supporting other, figure yeah. kind of person yeah, yeah. most of the time. And then sometimes kind of comes in and pinch hits and does Henna when he has to.
That sort of support for me comes from community and comes from my family, my biological family, also my chosen family. You're right that, you know, we would be lost without that.
Yes.
The legions of people holding us up do not often get seen. In much the same way, if I might go here for a second, in much the same way that tech people in theater are vital, but are not often seen, down to the point where, you know, we wear black so that when we are doing our work, you
Philip
can't see
us. Philip is very
in the
much stage crew scenes. And incredibly vital to what I do. He's got a hat. We got him a hat that says, "I'm with the band." He's very proud of it.
Oh, Philip.
If people who are listening to this podcast right now would like to stay in touch with you, buy your album, and keep up with what projects and gigs you're working on, how can they do that?
Well, the easiest way is that I am all over the web and you can Google me. My name is Lynn, L-Y-N-N, Noel, N-O-E-L. And you'll easily find my website, my Facebook, my LinkedIn, my YouTube, all on the first page of my search results because I've been on the web for a long time. If you're looking for my home website, it's lynnoel.com, lynnoel.com. There's with two N's, not three. That's because my college nickname was linoleum. Little known
really?
Fact.
Oh, man.
So you can join my mailing list at mailinglist.lynnoel.com. And again, that's L-Y-N-N-O-E-L with two N's.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for having a chat with us. It was our pleasure.
Yay. And mine.
Making Life Podcast is produced by Heather Kaunt-Nulton and Kate Clifford. You can find us at makinglifepodcast.com. And our music, as always, is brought to you by November Party.